I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order. Today is February 26, 2026, and the time is 3:31 p.m. We are here in Juneau, and present today, Senator Myers, Senator Klayman, and myself, Vice Chair Giesel. I know that Chair Dunbar is probably going to call in shortly. Oh, I don't.
I'm online, ma'am.
Oh, you're online. Great. Thank you so much, Senator Dunbar. Senator Tobin is presenting a bill in committee, so she is not with us right now. She'll probably be joining us later. But let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Mayor Gwynn and Renzo for taking the minutes down and helping us with the audio. Today we have one item on our agenda, and that's a presentation from Facing Foster Care in Alaska. So I will start by welcoming Facing Foster Care in Alaska to the committee. Our main presenter is Amanda Mativier. She is the Executive Director of Facing Foster Care in Alaska. So joining Ms. Mativier during the presentation are several youth from Facing Foster Care in Alaska. So that'll be great to hear from them. So welcome, Ms. Mativier. I'm turning to the pronunciation. Mativier.
You got it.
Yes. Thank you so much for being here. If you would put yourself on the record, give us your presentation, and of course, invite the students up as needed. Welcome. Yeah.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Amanda Mativier. I'm the executive director of Facing Foster Care in Alaska. I'm so grateful that you have all invited us to come and share some of our work and what is important to foster youth across the state. So really eager for this presentation. So thank you to Madam Chair, members of the committee. And congrats to Senator Dunbar on the new addition. So I wanted to start out first by talking a bit about our organization, who we are, what we do, why we exist, and then I'm going to invite up some of our members, some of our young people who are either in foster care right now or who have recently experienced foster care, to share some of their own personal lived experiences around some of the issues that we think are important. I'll share coming into this that I also have lived experience in the foster care system. I aged out of the system a very long time ago now, and soon after went on to become a foster parent. My husband and I fostered for 15 years. We fostered 21 teens and one little guy, my nephew. I have experience personally as having lived in this system, having been a caregiver in this system, and as a professional social worker working with young people. So Facing Foster Care in Alaska, we're a statewide nonprofit. We're a 501c3, and we've been around for 23 years now, which for me is hard to believe because I've been around the entire time. So we started out with support from KC Family Programs. It's a national foundation, and the Office of Children's Services Independent Living Program in its infancy. In 2003, it was sort of this hot new idea to listen to people with lived experience on how to shape child welfare systems. And so I was a young person in foster care at that time and got a call from my caseworker who said, hey, we think you'd be great to come and be a part of this youth advisory board, and we want to hear from you. And I thought, nobody's going to listen to anything we have to say, because that's really what it felt like being in the foster care system. And so I eventually signed on and started coming together with other young people across the state to be a part of this youth advisory board. And very quickly, I think we learned we needed autonomy from the state and some of these other organizations. And so we went and filed and brought on some community partners and became an official nonprofit. And we still work with KC Foundation today and very closely with the Office of Children's Services. We're a contractor for both those organizations. And I'm going to talk about some of the services we provide to with their support. So with that, sort of structurally, we have 300 current and former foster youth who are active members every year. So young people all across Alaska who are either currently in foster care right now, ages 15 and older, those who are in many different types of transition, going into permanent options through maybe reunification to their families, guardianship situation, adopted or a good majority of the young people that we engage with age out of the foster care system as adults, because we work with teens. Our membership ranges from age, well, we have our own sort of political process. So voting members are ages 15 to 24. So for those of us over 24, we're considered elders, and we don't get to decide on policy issues. We allow our organization to be driven by those who are experiencing the system in a way that's fresh. We have a statewide youth leadership board, and young people are elected into those positions every 2 years by our membership, and they represent the five regions that mirror the Office of Children's Services.
Could I interrupt for just a moment? Sure. Senator Klayman has a question.
Just a simple timing. You say when you age out of foster care, is there a specific age that that occurs, or is it where a person is? Because obviously people are still considered foster children into what we technically say is adulthood, but is there a specific age when you have to be out?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman. So for when a young person ages out of foster care, that means leaving foster care in adulthood. So in the state of Alaska, we extend foster care to age 21 for youth who opt into that. So at the age of 18, it's not a choice for young people in our state. So a caseworker can go to the courts and say, this young person, for example, hasn't graduated high school. They need more time. Or a young person might be ready to launch and they might leave care at 18. Mm-hmm. At 19, it's an option for young people in our state up to age 21. So annually, they would let the courts know, I want to remain in custody. And what we do know about the reasons why youth extend foster care is we have very high rates of young people who leave the system to homelessness, incarceration. So that transition to adulthood is far more challenging for many of us who don't have family support or who lack the life skills because of being in survival mode, really, and being in the system. So youth can age out at 18, 19, 20, 21.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
We also have so we have three full-time staff who all have lived experience, and then we have several contractors too. So we work with young people across the state, so we hire on in peer navigation type roles. So the services that we provide, one of the primary things we do is advocacy. So we teach young people across the state about their rights, what resources are available to them. And then we come to settings like this every year. We bring a group of young people from across the state to the Capitol. And we engage with all three branches of government over the course of 3 days. And so we have legislative visits. Sometimes we have items that we're advocating for, specific legislation, or just contact with offices about sometimes resolving issues for individual youth. But we also meet with the courts. Two of us serve on the State Court Improvement Program, and we also work very closely with OCS, their leadership and department leadership. So our youth leadership board meets with OCS leadership each quarter to talk about issues important to young people, and we work closely with them to try to solve those things without larger scale advocacy. But sometimes we do need a change in the law, or we do need an interpretation by the courts. We also lead training. So we teach foster youth how to share their experiences in a way that's going to be impactful, but also safe for them. And so we provide training for incoming caseworkers, foster parents, relative caregivers, and legal parties that show up in OCS cases. And we do that all with young people showing up to share their lived experiences so that a judge knows what it's like, right, in real time, day to day for a child in the system. We have sort of an informal network on peer support. So for a long time, it's just been a couple of us helping foster youth all over the state navigate really complex things that they experience. We're really fortunate this year we received support from the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and we're launching a formal peer navigator model where we're gonna match former foster youth all over the state to attend team meetings with them, court hearings, navigate transitions, the launch into adulthood, career readiness, you name it, that's our goal. We're going to show up and do it. And so they've given us support for 2 years, and we've received additional support from some foundations. And so our goal is to really launch this statewide over the next year and be in full force in 2027. And then finally, we also offer what we call financial empowerment or direct cash assistance. And so for young people transitioning out of foster care, you know, you make your way into the adult world and oftentimes things happen. And if you get a flat tire, like, who do you call? You know, you call your parents or an aunt or an uncle. Oftentimes we find that youth who are disconnected need additional financial support. And so we'll help cover costs, and we fundraise for this. We write grants for this. Support for housing, rent and back rent are our biggest request. Transportation, medical care. Sometimes it's paying for a pair of glasses because somebody's exhausted what they could get with Medicaid for the year. Or other basic needs. It could be transportation to and from a job, car repair, car part. And we find really creative ways to do that. We text young people Lyft credits or Uber rides so they can load it on their phone and have a ride. Oftentimes we try to direct pay things as an entity as much as possible to a vendor. So we don't just shell out cash.
Amanda, could you pause for a moment? Yep. Senator Myers has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you mentioned kind of an informal network. You talked a bunch about you talked a little bit at the beginning about having elections to get your board together. I'm kind of curious kind of how you do that. So, I mean, OCS is supposed to be, you know, very private, not supposed to share identities of who's of who either foster kids or foster parents are and the like. How do you put those networks together of young people?
Well, I think the beauty of being a nonprofit is that we're not OCS. And youth get to self-disclose. So youth voluntarily join, right, as members. We partner with OCS. We host three events a year that are sponsored by OCS that are statewide retreats. So there are these three-day events where we it's like a life skills training. It could be exposure to careers. We've partnered with the Laborers Training Camp, a number of organizations. So we have about 40 young people. We fly into Anchorage or the Matsu Valley for those events each quarter. But in the interim, we have this active network all the time. And for any young person that runs for our youth leadership board, they know they're going to be publicly exposing themselves. So if they are going to put themselves out there, right, to be in this position, in this leadership position, that could mean interaction with the media, showing up at trainings, youth know ahead of time sort of the risks and benefits of that. We also, I'll skip ahead a bit, some of the things we've advocated for over the years, one of the first things we actually worked on was freedom of speech for foster youth. Hmm. So when we first started, youth, we were making our way out to talk to caseworkers and to foster parents and to speak at conferences. And an attorney general for the state in, I think it was 2005, said that youth in foster care couldn't speak publicly without a court order. And we involved a state lawmaker who then did some negotiation with the state. And we found that they were interpreting an old statute about, like, the name or picture of a child in foster care couldn't have been released without a court order. Mm. And so we had a formal interpretation. I have a letter from the attorney general at the time that says youth can self-disclose for their own experiences and their story. Okay. Sorry, through the chair.
Just quick follow-up.
Senator Myers.
Thank you. You said you start engaging youth at about age 15 or so. Of the youth in that age bracket in the foster care system, just kind of a rough guesstimate about how many of them do you think you guys managed to make contact with, touch, bring into your activities, et cetera?
So data-wise, through the chair, Senator Meyer, I don't know the numbers for 15 and older in custody. It's about a quarter of those in foster care are teens, 15 and up. For young people who are eligible for transition services through OCS in and out of custody, ages 16 to 21, we have 800 young people, just over 800 young people statewide.
Okay.
So our reach, 300 annually, and we have a goal to get to 500 over the next 2 years. Is still, right, it doesn't meet the mark in terms of all the youth out there.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Good. I'll let you proceed.
Yeah. I'll go back a slide. So as I mentioned, we're a nonprofit. A good portion of our funding as an organization is actually foundation funds, and state level foundations. So, organizations in state who support our work. We do have some agreements. We have a contract with the Office of Children's Services, like I mentioned, to offer those life skills events. We also have a contract with public health to provide some support and training for young people. And then we get some corporate money from, you know, like banks and architects and other organizational sponsors.
Senator Klayman.
Can you, on the graph that you've just shown us, because it's many shades of blue. could you just tell us the percentages of the different, the four entities? Don't worry about trying to tell me which color, but if you'll just tell me the percentages, that would be great.
I don't have, Senator Klayman through the chair, I don't have percentages. I have actual numbers. So for FY26, our foundation dollars that we have brought in is $341,000. Individual contributions from people, we're only halfway through the year, is about $80,000. Government contracts is close to $200,000, and corporate is just over $10,000.
Thank you. Further questions, Senator Klayman?
Nope, thank you.
All right, I'll let you proceed, Amanda.
And I'll add, this is a lot of just volunteer time and applying for grants and fundraising and asking the community for money. So it's a lot of me after hours writing narratives and working with our board of directors to, you know, try to hammer out budgets. And the climate right now for nonprofits is a real challenge. And so we've tried to not over rely on government funding and really reach out to the community and find other sources that are more stable. Okay, so continuing on, thank you. Advocacy over the years, I've listed some things out here. I mentioned the effort to really promote, try to promote freedom of speech. We have a multi-pronged approach to advocating for changes to the foster care system. So part of that is, like I mentioned before, working directly with OCS or DFCS and department leadership to try to resolve issues. Sometimes that's one-on-one advocacy for young people who are experiencing challenges in their case right now and being a voice for them. We also work closely with the courts. So several of us serve on the Court Improvement Program, which is a statewide committee of legal parties involved in OCS cases. So we had a recent win in 2022. We worked closely with Court Improvement and we passed new court rules. So with those rules came notice to youth in foster care of any hearings they had related to their case, and then mandatory appointments of attorneys in specific circumstances. And so mandatory appointments for youth if they are in foster care and pregnant and parenting, or facing placement in residential care, refuse psychotropic medications, or on runaway status, which sometimes I like to refer to it as self-placement, or would otherwise benefit from a confidential relationship. So for young people in the system, while there are many people who show up on an OCS case, none of those relationships are confidential outside of an attorney. And not every young person in our state is appointed an attorney outside of a guardian ad litem. So it meets a real need, especially for older youth. Who are navigating all kinds of things in life. So we work with OCS, we work with the courts. Sometimes that's challenging things in court, and I'll talk about that here in a minute. And coming to the legislature, and we've worked with several of you on issues over the years as well to try to identify ways to find solutions for young people. And so that's resulted in extended foster care, support for young people in transition, timelines for moving quickly toward permanency to get youth out of the system, staff positions at OCS, contact with relatives, searching for relatives, youth rights, probably too many things to name that have come to fruition over the last two decades. But I think we really started to find a lot of success, too, when we started bringing young people down here to Juneau. Youth get a lot from the opportunity and interacting with state lawmakers and with staff. But I've seen a real impact from the time that we started doing an event where we fly young people in, and they have an opportunity to get before each of you. We also do some advocacy work at the federal level. So right now we're advocating for some supports for some of the funding for young people in transition. That's federal dollars through the Foster Care Independence Act. It's slow going, and there's a number of advocates across the country, but oftentimes we partner with similar organizations to ours across states. So we are facing foster care in Alaska, but there are FFCAs in most states under different names, and many of them we work closely with.
So a question, Amanda. The young people are in different stages of some kind of oversight. Who gives consent for them to seek medical care?
Depends, Madam Chair. It depends on the circumstance for a young person with regard to seeking medical care. Mm-hmm. So in the state of Alaska, youth at a certain age have a right to seek reproductive health care. For young people in foster care, they have that same right, but they could not consent independently to something like a COVID shot, a flu shot, psychotropic medication. Parents hold those rights if parents' rights are still intact. If parents' rights have been terminated to a child in foster care, that decision goes to the caseworker.
I see. So my main interest is the consent to seek mental health services. Mm-hmm. And so they would probably fall under the same category that you just described.
Absolutely. Yeah. So right now, any medical right consent outside of reproductive health for a child in custody is with their legal guardian. So if their parent has rights, it would be their parent. And if the parent doesn't have rights, it would be OCS.
Do you ever encounter homeless youth? How does that consent work?
Madam Chair, so for young people who are experiencing homelessness, we engage with youth who are both in foster care and experiencing homelessness. We've experienced that more in recent years with young people sleeping in offices or shelters or hotels. And as they've made their transition to independence, I also used to work at a youth shelter. And so oftentimes that means just connecting them with public health or trying to reach out to a caseworker. I can tell you a lot of those things are challenging for youth to navigate, and they could probably speak better to that than me. But to be in the system and try to get the right care that's consistent can be a challenge. As a foster parent, I had young people in my home that sometimes I didn't get a Medicaid number or any medical history. I didn't know about allergies or any issues, shots, who their providers were, dental care. And with each new placement, it's like you're starting over and can be an even greater challenge once youth are unaccompanied and out in the world on their own. But a lot of that falls with the caseworker for young people in custody that are experiencing homelessness. We helped pass legislation in 2018. Through House Bill 151, and some of you are involved with that, that required youth receive their important documents upon exiting foster care, so like a birth certificate and social security card, tribal identification card. There's still challenges with youth getting that documentation when they leave care, and that creates challenges to accessing health care and communicating with public assistance. So foster youth are also eligible under the Affordable Care Act. If they age out at age 18, they're eligible for Medicaid till age 26 with no income test. But oftentimes that's not information that youth get either. So we help navigate that and oftentimes have to involve support through like legal services to challenge public assistance.
Thank you. Senator Klayman.
I see on the top of the slide that's in front of us, House Bill 36. I'm guessing that that's your top legislative priority for this year. And how does that relate to the very topic you're talking about youth wanting to be able to get psychiatric treatment?
So, Senator Klayman, through the chair, I'm actually going to start inviting up some of our young people to speak to some of these issues. So I'm not just a talking head. And so our policy agenda is on this page, and you should also have the handout. And I'm going to walk through each of these items one by one. So that first one is House Bill 36. It's made its way through the House. It's in Senate Finance now. I know there are other things added to this bill as well, but the I think most important piece for us that's been a longstanding issue is around placement in hospitals for acute psychiatric treatment. So we've seen for the last two decades, and the United States Department of Justice has come to say the same thing, that Alaska has overutilized acute care, residential care for young people in our state, but particularly those in foster care. And as we've had a steady decline in foster homes in recent years, we've seen more reliance on hospitals. Again, I mentioned young people sleeping in offices and hotels. And there was a case that went to the Alaska Supreme Court that said the justices came back and said youth get a hearing within 30 days. That's far too long. And the legislature needs to fix it was kind of the narrative that they gave. But what we've seen is young people who are placed in acute hospitals just for placement purposes. And so we want a hearing. I think the language as it stands now is within 7 days to put it before a judge and to allow the judge to decide whether that young person does need a higher level of care and does need to be in an acute setting to stabilize, or if they could step down into something or move into a lower level situation. And so we also see young people receiving being released from some of these facilities on the 29th day to avoid the hearing prior to the current injunction that says 30 days for a hearing. Youth were hospitalized for months on end, and they didn't really have a right to any sort of due process to get before a judge. So a judge said 30 days. Now the Supreme Court says that's too long. What we really want is 72 hours, but we're compromising. Because again, if we're relying on hospital settings as a placement and not for actual need, it's a dangerous place to be. And we've heard from young people over and over. So if it's okay, I'm actually going to invite Tali up to talk on this. You ready?
Welcome, Tali.
Hello. For the record, my name is Tali Tonu Isawinga Stone. I reside in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm representing myself. I'm here to speak on House Bill 36, which will allow foster youth placed in psychiatric facilities to have a court hearing within 7 days to determine if they meet their criteria for such a high level of care. I was placed in North Star while I was in care in total of 4 times. Each and every time, I did not get a court hearing to help determine if I truly needed to be in the facility. Though OCS was told that I did not need to be in their facility, they still had me in there and every time for longer than a month. I was isolated away from my family and my siblings in the outside world for months on end. And since I was placed in North Star more than once, they almost sent me out of state to Arizona for long-term treatment, something that OCS was aware of I didn't need. Fortunately, they were able to find a placement for me, but youth shouldn't be placed in a psychiatric facility because there are no placements available. That's why it's important for youth or foster youth to have a court hearing within 7 days to determine whether they need to be placed within a psychiatric facility for treatment, because it is a resource that could be used for other youth and children that do need it.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for Tali? Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm not sure which of the two might want to answer this question here. Referred to running away as self-placement, and I can see where you're going with that. I'm a little curious. My understanding is if somebody runs away from a psychiatric facility that the troopers get involved and the youth that end up somewhere else. So does that mean that now if that is the case, effectively running away from a place where they haven't gotten a court hearing then lands them in jail? Is that what ends up happening?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, this is Amanda Mativier. It's harder to run away from a facility that has the front doors locked. So typically we see youth running away from maybe foster homes or shelter settings or settings that they don't feel safe or comfortable for a number of reasons. But it could land. Yeah. So it's usually a catch and release where for young people who are on a runaway status, they may be picked up by law enforcement, regardless of where they're running from, and placed maybe overnight in a detention facility. Unless OCS is involved quickly. It depends, you know, time of day, if the troopers are involved, if, you know, community, things like that.
Okay. Thank you.
Follow up, Senator Myers?
Yeah, just to say, I'd like to follow up with you on that a little bit after the hearing's over.
Absolutely.
Senator Klayman had a question.
Just a brief comment on the work we did in the Senate Judiciary Committee on House Bill 36. A lot of study of those Supreme Court opinions, a lot of looking at the specific details that were challenged or that were challenging. And I recognize that you all are asking for a shorter time to the hearing. And I know part of what we worked through with the different folks involved was coming up with the 7 days. And so I know exactly why you'd like those hearings sooner. But I think the legislation captures some of the very concerns that you've raised. And I'm optimistic that if we can get that bill passed this year, that you'll really see some changes in what you see on the ground. And I really appreciate your coming on and testifying, because being in psychiatric care when you shouldn't be for 30 days is horrible.
Thank you. Thank you, Telly.
Senator Klayman, we also absolutely, through the chair, we also appreciate your leadership on that issue. I know there are other pending issues around conditions in some of these facilities, but I think, again, this has been something that's been going on for decades. And so for the legislature to really take this on as something to fix, I think is absolutely necessary. And we were really happy to get to this place. So we're just hoping it gets kicked over the finish line before the end of session.
Senator Klayman?
I would be remiss if I did not give Senator Giesel a lot of credit. She was very involved in lots of discussions on pieces of that same legislation.
So I'm going to move on to our next issue in our policy agenda, and I'm actually going to ask Landon to come up and talk and speak to this issue. There's a bill right now. It needs a hearing in House Health and Social Services. It's House Bill 157, and it's specific to sibling connections and relationships. And what this bill would do is it would, if passed, consider siblings, legal siblings, post-adoption. So oftentimes what we see, right, if siblings are separated into multiple foster homes or different caregiver situations, if one sibling or multiple siblings are being adopted by a caregiver and the other is not, they are no longer legal relatives. So that relationship severs. So this has been something that's been really important to our membership for a very long time, and it seems simple, and it seems really common sense. But I'm going to invite Landon to share on this issue.
Welcome, Landon.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Landon Ryan. I reside in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm currently attending Robert Service High School as a senior, and I'm representing myself. I'm specifically here to talk about House Bill 157 and why sibling relationships matter to me and how being separated from my brother has affected the course of my life. When I first entered foster care, my brother Riley and I were placed with two distant family members as a temporary foster placement. That temporary placement eventually became permanent through adoption. However, after years of negligence and abuse from our adopted parents, we were placed back into the foster care system. And this time we were separated from each other. For years, we went without contact. Our lives continued separately, and over time, our relationship became nothing more than a name in a contact list. What was once a strong bond and a brotherhood slowly turned into a fragmented connection. My brother and I no longer speak. I will never have the memories of growing up with a loving older brother, just as I will never know what it feels like to grow up in a consistent and dependable family. Because of that loss, I think I have found my purpose. I hope to give new foster kids and teenagers the experiences I was never able to have. I want to help them build and maintain healthy, strong relationships with their siblings and the kind of relationships that can survive all the hardships every single person goes through in the course of their life. It is my personal mission to make sure children in care have the opportunity to create lasting memories with their siblings. Thank you, Senators and Madam Chair, for allowing me to speak my testimony.
Thank you, Landon. Of course. Questions for Landon?
Okay.
Thank you.
We have, I'll keep moving along. We have several other items. I'll start going a little bit faster. I don't know how we're doing on time, but another issue on our policy agenda is with regard to Social Security. So a longstanding practice by state child welfare agencies has been to reimburse themselves for the cost of care using a child's Social Security disability and a child's Social Security survivor benefits if a parent has passed. Just recently, in recent months, the Children's Bureau at the federal level sent a notice to governors, 39 states, including the state of Alaska, and said that in situations where states were collecting Social Security survivor benefits or death benefits on behalf of children in care, they could no longer reimburse themselves using that money. So OCS immediately stopped that practice. We connected with them on a policy around this, so they're now holding that funding in accounts for young people so that they have that for transition or for later. The state is still collecting Social Security disability on behalf of eligible young people and reimbursing itself. We've had several youth who have challenged this through the courts. It's made its way through the Alaska Supreme Court. Our Supreme Court said that youth had a right to notice if OCS was applying for benefits on behalf of children in its custody, and that youth could identify a separate payee, which oftentimes young people in care don't have those external supports to identify as a payee. So we have a bill. We're working closely with the Office of Representative Carolyn Hall to draft, and we found model legislation in Arizona that would put this money in a trust fund in the same way that young people in foster care's permanent fund dividends are held in trust. A number of states across the country have moved away from the practice of reimbursing itself through Social Security. From what I understand, this is about $2.5 million of the OCS budget. But they would still collect Title IV-E federal money for these young people as a part of their cost to support foster care in addition to what they pull through the general fund. So I was just going to speak to this one, but I don't know if there's questions before we move on to the next.
Amanda, Senator Myers had a question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I saw a news article on this a few years ago and dug into it a little bit. My understanding at the time was federal law actually effectively the state got the would apply for the benefits because the federal law prohibited the benefits from going directly to the child. So effectively either the state took the benefits or the benefits disappeared into thin air. And so you've mentioned apparently there's a change on the survivor benefit side, but you also mentioned the disability benefits. What's the status of federal law there?
Senator Meyer, through the chair. So federal law allows, they have a sequence for who could be the payee for a young person in foster care, mm-hmm. and the state is at the bottom of that. So first it's a relative, right, or like an adult support. They have sort of slow and steady move toward the narrative of this is up to states. And so some states have voluntarily said, we're not going to collect this. Historically, the state of Alaska did actually hold disability benefits for Social Security in trust funds for young people. States hire these companies, from what I understand, that come in and help them figure out cash flow and how to manage cash in the way of healthcare and other things. And so when that happened, it's been about 20 years now. The state started to collect that money that they were applying for on behalf of young people to reimburse themselves rather than hold it in a trust. So we did have a practice as a state at one point where this money was set aside, and we could still do that. It's up again. The state could do this at any point, but it could also be legislated. So it's a voluntary thing that could happen.
Okay. Thank you.
So moving on from Social Security onto housing, this is not a bill related, a legislative related item, but it is an issue that, as we've talked to several lawmakers, folks have been interested in. And I don't know if Katie's willing to come up, but maybe she'll just wave to you. Young people in our state take a survey at ages 17, 19, and 21, and this happens across the country, to ask them about housing, if they have access to medical care, employment, education. Really, it's to get a gauge on where youth in transition are. So for the most recent data from the National Youth in Transition Database for Alaska, as of last year, 45% of foster youth in Alaska were reporting that they had experienced homelessness by age 21. The federal government has issued vouchers through HUD to states so that youth could access a housing voucher and only pay up to 30% of their income for 3 years, with a potential 2-year extension if they're enrolled in higher education or an employment training program. And this is called the Foster Youth to Independence Voucher. Alaska is unique in that Alaska Housing Finance Corporation is the only entity that manages these vouchers. From what I understand, other states have housing authorities beyond the one. So foster youth in our state can only access these vouchers if they live in one of 12 communities served by Alaska Housing. They are unlimited. So we started with 22. The OCS Independent Living Program staff have worked very, very hard to fill those positions of youth in vouchers so they could be out on their own. But for youth who live in rural communities across the state, they have zero access to that. And nearly half of young people who leave care in our state are ending up homeless. And so Katie, it's okay if I share, she'll raise her hand. Katie in the back and Diane, her twin, who had popped in and out. Katie George is from Scammon Bay. And had aged out of the system and recently made her way to Anchorage to try to access a voucher because that wouldn't be available in her community. It wouldn't even be available in a hub community like Bethel. So she came to Anchorage. She re-entered foster care and didn't have the best experience because of limited options in foster homes and made her way back home and left the system. And we have a number of young people experiencing this. They're aging out in rural communities throughout the state, but can't access the FYI, which has been a resource in so many states across the country for youth to launch fully. We average about 100 young people annually in extended foster care, so 18 to 21. Those are all youth who are potentially eligible for a voucher or potentially eligible to be out on their own, right? Practice navigating the world with support to launch. So I'll move on from housing. My next topic is on higher education, and I'm going to ask Deco to come up. This is an issue that came up in recent months, and we wanted you to be aware of it. It's something that youth have been very outspoken about. So foster youth in transition have access to a few things. They have access to a foster youth tuition waiver through University of Alaska campuses, through APU, and they also have access to some federal funding, up to $5,000 a year for higher education. Historically, OCS has contracted out support through a coordinator position to work with youth who are preparing to graduate from high school and on through their higher education experience. I actually sat in that position. I was in that job for 10 years, and there was someone else recently who left. In the fall, when the individual who used to be in that role left, OCS cut that position. So we average about 50 young people annually who are in college. Many of them are in foster care, living in the dorms across the state. OCS has opted to have their independent living program staff, who already have caseloads well over 100, to try to absorb this work. So I've asked Deco to speak on this issue.
Welcome, Deco.
Hi. Thank you for having me, Chair, ma'am. My name is Deco Harvey, for the record, and I am representing myself. I am from Anchorage, Alaska, and currently attending the University of Alaska Anchorage, and do live on campus there as well. So the biggest issue that I have had is the coordinator who was in that position previously. I worked with her from my junior year of high school, going through my SATs and ACTs, graduating on time, to starting my classes in the fall. And from there, she would contact me, and she did everything to help me. She helped me move into the dorms for the first time. I didn't have a car. I didn't have any family to call. I was completely by myself. Once I got a job and started getting some more money, she helped me figure out what I needed to buy, to live on my own. Things that I didn't really think about previously, that I didn't have the guidance of any parents or anyone to tell me to go get those things or tell me that I needed those things. She helped me do those things. She also helped me do grown-up tasks like filing my taxes and figuring out how to apply for my FAFSA properly as a foster kid. And all of those things that she helped us do were crucial. And a lot of it was because she had firsthand experience with the Alaska university system. She went to UAA, so she knew how the system worked. When that transition happened and the position no longer existed, it caused a lot of chaos. It was the fall, this fall, right before school started. We had questions about classes that were available or weren't available. We had questions about how FAFSA was affected by new federal laws and stuff that went into place. We had a lot of things that needed to be handled, and a lot of it wasn't handled. The OCS workers, the IL specialists that are supposed to do these things have, like Amanda said, hundreds of cases. And a lot of those cases are about surviving day to day for other foster youth. And I know that because I was one of those cases, one of those people who had to survive day to day, figure out where I was going to be tomorrow, what I was going to eat tomorrow, where I was going to sleep tomorrow. And I didn't really think about anything further than just that day. But when you are finally trying to make that transition out of OCS care and you're in college and you're trying to handle classes with work and all this other stuff that still may be happening with your family as it was with mine, it becomes difficult to not have anyone to go to not have anyone to call. The student coordinator also happened to be the emergency contact for me and quite a few of my friends who were from the foster care system. And when the position got eliminated, they no longer have emergency contacts. I no longer have that emergency contact anymore. And it became very difficult for us to navigate this semester, this previous fall semester. One of my friends actually ended up dropping out because of how scary and lonely the process had become. Part of what that coordinator did was set up events and activities for us to do throughout Anchorage during the breaks, like Thanksgiving break, Christmas break, all those other holiday breaks where you don't have any of your friends on campus because they're all going home to their families and you're by yourself in your dorm. Nowhere else to go, nothing else to do, and it's a very sad and hard time for foster youth. It takes a toll on our mental health, and it did take a toll on my friend's mental health this year. When the kind of stability that was starting out for him went away, and that stability for me also went away, and it became a lot harder for us to figure things out with school. And we would call, or I called my OCS worker and asked her, hey, I have, a fee or a hold on my account. I had a hold on my account from fall semester that I couldn't apply for my spring classes yet. So I called her and I said, I don't know what this hold is or why it's there. Can you help me figure it out? Can you come with me, talk to financial aid and figure out what's going on? And she told me that she didn't even know how to log in to the student account. She didn't know where the hold was coming from, who put it there. And she asked me if I knew who to talk to. And if I did know, I wouldn't have called her. So I think it's really important for OCS to bring that position back. They do have the funding for that position, and I'm not sure what they're doing with that funding now, but they do have the funding and it works. It's a position that's been around for quite some time, and it has helped many foster youth graduate on time and be like more healthy and happy and better adults after graduation. And taking that away is like taking a step back into the way that things used to be. And taking that step back has affected a lot of us. It has affected me personally, as well as my friends that I know who went through foster care. I met through FFCA, and I would really encourage you guys, sorry for taking so long, but to consider telling OCS to bring it back, because we really need it.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Deco?
Thank you.
Thank you, Deco.
Thank you for having me.
I have two more technically, so we'll kind of breeze through. So this next one, I'm going to ask Maddie to come up. This one is specific to the cost of care. Our organization worked with the legislature in 2008 to pass extended foster care. So young people can extend their time in care up to age 21. They can reenter the system. And in 2016, we worked to expand that to allow youth to be in more creative placements, because oftentimes it's hard to find a foster home for a teen or a young adult, but also allowing youth to live independently in dorms or transitional living programs. What didn't follow that was the funding support. And so, as I mentioned, there's about 100 young people in extended foster care annually. Right now, there are about 50 young people that are in extended foster care in non-foster home placements that are paying all their own costs to live. So there's no foster care reimbursement rate going to a foster parent. So youth are paying for their own housing, their own food, their own clothing. And sometimes these situations are pretty dire. And so we've seen a lot of challenges in that. I talked to our attorneys before this, and they said it was okay. We did recently file a lawsuit against the state for cost of care, asking OCS to cover this. In a number of states across the country, states have moved toward the practice of offering youth that monthly foster care rate if they're in these independent settings while they're in state custody, to help them budget, cover the cost of food, cover the cost of housing, transportation, medical care, whatever it may be. And they could do that voluntarily at any point. So I'm going to turn it up to Maddie to talk about this, and then I'll move toward wrapping up.
Hi, Maddie. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Madison Brewer. I reside in Anchorage, and I'm representing myself. As a person who is using the extended foster care, extended foster care bill?
What? You're in extended foster care.
Yeah, I'm extended foster care. It's definitely been difficult. For my situation, I have a family who help, but even to that extent, it's not enough. Even with, the housing voucher, I get things covered, yes, but I am also, I have a hard time getting to get food consistently. I just have a hard time with the food that's on campus, so I have to pay, for my own food, and, like, even from a certain amount that I get from my grandparents, it's not always enough, especially as grocery bills and, you know, everything's getting more expensive. It gets hard to be able to sustain myself. On top of that, like, anything that happens, like, out of the blue that I have to cover, I don't have that. If my grandparents don't have it, then I kind of am left to figure it out. And I have help, like, I, you know, work with FFCA and everything, but it's still, like, you know, so as long I just would really appreciate supporting this. So
I was going to say thanks, Maddie, for youth in situations like Maddie, who live in dorm settings or other transitional living settings, the idea around extended foster care is for youth who don't have parental support and need sort of a longer runway to launch and to get ready. And so oftentimes the burden falls on these young people who are living in state care to cover their own costs.
Any questions for Maddie? Yes, Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I'm just curious if we're talking about a non-foster home setting and there is not a foster care reimbursement, what does OCS provide, and kind of what then is the point of being in the extended foster care?
You want me to talk?
No, they don't do anything. That, like, there's, like, the money that would have gone, because technically I have a placement, which is on campus, but there's over $1,000 from that that just goes back into the system that I don't get any, like, I don't get to touch, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of also, I think, why we're trying to talk about it. I just forgot.
Is it okay if I add? I'll add. So extended foster care for a lot of young people is twofold. It's about a social. It's about a sort of security, social safety net of having a caseworker, having someone check on you, right? For anyone that has an adult child, right? Your kid goes off to college, and you're going to check in on them, right? What happens when you don't have parents? So for a lot of young people, it's that additional support and knowing, right, that there's more time that's needed to practice life skills and things like that. The state has access to federal funding through the Chaffee Foster Care Independence Act. So youth have access to what's called independent living funds. That's only $3,000 a year for young people in custody. So that's not going to, you know, pay for food for a whole year or pay for housing for a whole year or transportation. That's actually funding that the federal government is looking to increase, and we're doing work at the federal level to try to make that happen. It's been stagnant since 1999. There's education and training funds. That's $5,000 a year. That goes very quickly for a young person in college, even though they're deemed independent. And same thing, there's efforts at the federal level to increase that. That's been stagnant since 2005. So it is pretty minimal outside of, right, like someone showing up if you get a home visit. So for a lot of older youth with staffing issues and challenges with the state, that might mean prioritizing a younger child, right? And so for older youth, you're really on your own. But the idea is that you're going to have additional support from the state for, you know, practicing independence, managing life skills, doing all the things I think we would want to do for our own kids as they're launching out into the world.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Maddie.
And I would be remiss by talking about all of this if I didn't talk about the importance of some of the past reforms. So as I mentioned, we worked to pass landmark legislation in 2018. It was House Bill 151, the Children Deserve a Loving Home Act. And every member of the state legislature signed on to that but one at the time. And that was around figuring out workforce issues to be able to support children and families. And so it was about reducing caseloads, increasing training for frontline child welfare workers, support for older youth and siblings. And there were a number of things in that legislation and a series of audits, which I'm sure you've paid attention to in recent months. And so I think a lot of these things could be improved, right? Or the day-to-day challenges that youth and families face could be improved if a caseworker had time to show up. And so a part of that is getting in front of some of the staffing challenges. And I think a part of that as a professional social worker, and I also oversaw OCS training for a point in time, is about meeting the mark in terms of pay scale for hiring qualified individuals to show up and do this work. So the state moved toward a system of competency-based hiring around 2019. Mm-hmm. And so majority of folks that are hired to do frontline casework, which is really first responder, emergency response type work, have very minimal qualifications and skills and expertise to do that. And it's created more challenges for youth and families. And so I'll just end with our contact information, our website. We're out visiting offices and around through tomorrow and some of us Saturday. But again, thanks to the committee for allowing time for this.
Thank you for your presentation, Amanda. It's important stuff, and I really appreciate the students being here. That is really impactful. Appreciate hearing from them. Any questions from committee members? All right. Senator Dunbar did have to drop off, but thank you very much for being here and for bringing the kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. It does. You do learn a lot coming and actually seeing how all of this works and perhaps inspire them to sit in these seats one day.
That's the hope.
Good. All right. Well, that concludes our agenda for today. Our next meeting will be next Tuesday, March 3rd. We're going to hear from the Office of Children's Services regarding the 2025 audit report. So with that, we will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 4:30 p.m.